Welcome to the Darrell McClain Show. I'm your host, Darrell McClain, and let's get into our episode.
Simply search for the T-Bone and Chick Brew podcast, available wherever fine podcasts are sold.
The Darrell McClain Show is fully listener-supported, independent media that won't lead you to tribalism. You can get a membership for as little as $3 a month at www.patreon.com/TheDarrellMcClain Show.
We talk about a lot of serious topics on this show. One very serious topic is women's health. One company that stood out to me was VSlay.com because the owner is very transparent about her own struggles in the women's health department and has great customer service, great deals, and frequent sales. You can check her out, her great customer service, products about women's health, and frequent sales at www.VSlay.com. That is www.VSlay.com.
You cannot change the world. But you can shame the guilty. I was asked to bring back the quotes of the day. That one is fresh in my head. That is a quote from the late Jessica Mitford. Welcome to the show. So, I got a bit of good news. We did the last episode about the professor, associate professor, at Old Dominion University who was trying to normalize pedophilia by using the term MAP, Minor Attractive Persons. I'd like to read a new statement from Old Dominion. Old Dominion University has placed Dr. Alan Walker on administrative leave effective immediately from their position as Assistant Professor of Sociology and Criminal Justice. Reactions to Dr. Walker's research and a book have led to concerns for their safety and that of the campus. Furthermore, the controversy over Dr. Walker's research has disrupted the campus and community environment and is re-interfering with the institution's mission of teaching and learning. I want to state, this is same from the professor, I want to state the strongest terms possible that child sexual abuse is morally wrong and has no place in our society. I'm sorry, this is from ODU President Brian D. Hampel, PhD. This is a challenging time for our university, but I'm confident that we will come together and move forward as a monarch family. These actions we're taking today are motivated by our obligations to maintain a safe and conducive learning environment for our students, faculty, and staff. So that is, at least that for now. Of course, the job of the public is to, I'm not going to say hound this professor to death, but we will have to pay attention to see if they do get a job at another university. And there's nothing wrong with anybody getting a job, but we are going to be paying attention to what the professor is trying to teach. Like I said, in the last show notes, I left the entire 28-minute interview with the now ex-professor explaining their ideology around pedophilia, and you can check it out on your own. With bizarre stuff, and of course, this whole thing was trying to sell books. So if you want to buy that book and there's further evidence, and there you have it. So let's take a quick visit to Trump land and talk about a bit of legal issues. The Trump White House records can now be turned over to the House January 6th Investigation Committee, a judge has ruled. So a federal judge in Washington ruled late Tuesday that hundreds of pages of Trump White House records can be turned over to a congressional committee investigating the January 6th attack on Capitol Hill, despite the former president's objection to the decision by the U.S. District Judge Tanya S. Chocton, clears the way for the release of the government records requested by Congress beginning Friday. Attorneys for former President Donald Trump immediately appealed and moved to bar the release of the documents by the National Archives pending a ruling by the U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia Circuit. The House panel and the Justice Department contended that discovering coming to terms with the causes of underlying the January 6th attacks is a matter of unsurpassed public importance because the information relates to our core democratic institutions and the public confidence in them. Chuckleton, I'm probably just destroying this guy's name. It's spelled C-H-T-K-A-N. But anyway, Chuckleton wrote in a 39-page opinion, the court agrees.
Investigating the attempted insurrection at the Capitol faces an uphill battle with the Trump administration officials it wants to question.
This is the House Select Committee that is tasked with investigating the insurrection on Capitol Hill that happened on January 6th while Congress was certifying or attempting to certify the electoral results of the 2020 election won by Joe Biden.
The Select Committee is composed of 7 House Democrats and 2 Republicans. So far, 4 former Trump administration officials have been subpoenaed: Steve Bannon, Mark Meadows, Kash Patel, and Dan Scavino. There's a lot of resistance to these subpoenas as individuals claim that they're protected by executive privilege rules that are meant to protect conversations with presidents. For example, Bannon's refusal to comply with the subpoena resulted in a committee vote to hold him in criminal contempt of Congress.
We believe Mr. Bannon has information relevant to our probe, and we'll use the tools at our disposal to get that information.
The full House of Representatives voted the same way as the committee.
Take away a court's power to subpoena witnesses, and it fails to be a court. Take away the Congress's ability to do the same, and it fails to be a Congress.
The House has voted in favor of sending the contempt resolution to the DOJ. This is in the hands of the Justice Department to decide whether or not they're going to pursue prosecution of contempt, of the contempt referral. That means that Steve Bannon could potentially face a misdemeanor criminal offense with up to a year in prison or a $100,000 fine.
The strategy behind those subpoenaed may be to slow the progress of the January 6th committee as much as possible.
Hundreds of defendants in the January 6th events have been complying with the law since then, and that is essential to the continuation of the rule of law in America. But there's no exception for presidents, much less former political cronies of the president.
The legal battle that unfolds from this lack of cooperation drags out a timeline that the committee may not have.
They are on a time crunch. They're trying to get this done as expeditiously and as quick as possible.
With the midterm elections coming up, Republicans could retake the House, and because the January 6th committee was established on party lines, it exists at the discretion of whichever party is in power, meaning the Democratic established group would likely dissolve in a Republican House.
Some legal scholars have said to us that even if the DOJ does decide to prosecute this contempt referral for Steve Bannon, that still could take quite a bit of time. It's not necessarily faster. So there's a lot of TBDs there, and you're trying to keep track of all of these witnesses and these people of interest to the committee as closely as possible.
So what you just heard was footage from Reuters Associated Press. So anyway, the quote is, the court holds the public interest lies in permitting, not enjoining, the combined will of the legislative and executive branch to study the events that led and occurred on January 6th and consider legislation to prevent such events from ever occurring again, the judge wrote. House Democrats are probing Trump's communications and activities leading up to and during the riot by a mob of his supporters that contributed to at least 5 deaths and forced the evacuation of Congress as it met to certify the 2020 presidential election results. In court filings, the House has argued that it needs to communications records of then President Donald Trump, who helped, who helped foment the breakdown in the rule of law by assembling thousands of supporters in Washington after months of long efforts to falsely brand the 2020 election as stolen. On January 18th, Trump sued the chairman of the House of the January 6th Select Committee and the head of the National Archives in an attempt to stop the handover of the executive branch records sought by the panel. Trump's attorneys objected to the release of the records, saying that as a former president, he retained a residual right to assert executive privilege, even though President Biden had waived it. Presidents require full and frank advice to carry out their duties, and the confidentiality of such deliberations must survive more than a few months or years after they leave office to protect the institution of the presidency, his lawyers asserted. The appeals court set an initial written briefing deadline for December 27th, and Trump overnight asked Trumpton for an emergency injunction barring release of the documents pending appeal. Legal analysts say that the fight is expected to continue well into next year, with the delay potentially working to Trump's advantage if the courts have not settled the question before November 2022 midterm election, when Republicans hope to unseat this Democratic Congress. In a statement on Twitter, Trump spokesman Taylor Bowditch said the legal struggle is just beginning. Quote, the battle to defend the executive privilege for presidents past, present, and future was destined to be decided by the appellate court. Bowditch said in a written statement, President Trump remains committed to defending the Constitution and the office of the presidency, and will be seeing this process through. In her ruling, however, Chakta noted that Biden administration had approved the release of his predecessor's White House records. There could only be one president at a time, the judge wrote, holding that Trump's assertion of executive privileges is outweighed by President Biden's decision not to uphold that privilege. Presidents are not kings, and the plaintiff is not the president. The judge went on to say, echoing language used by fellow jurist Dr. John B. Jackson in 2019 in rejecting Trump's request to toss out a congressional subpoena seeking testimony by his White House counsel, Donald McGahn. Quote, he, Trump, retains the right to assert that his records are privileged, but the incumbent president is not constitutionally obliged to honor that assertion. The judge went on to add that she would not second guess a decision by undertaking a document by document review as requested by Trump's attorney, saying that required the court to engage in a function reserved squarely for the executive. The ruling is upheld. If upheld, could greatly speed the work of the committee. The nearly 800 pages of documents that Trump has sought to have withheld, many such as White House visitor and call logs, are unavailable elsewhere. Other responsive records identified by the National Archives includes emails, other communications, draft speeches, and talking points on election irregularities and memos regarding potential lawsuits against states by and one. They also include potential or scheduled briefings and telephone calls concerning the January 6th certification and other election issues, and a draft of an executive order on the topic of election integrity. The district court has delivered an important victory for the Constitution, for the rule of law, and the American people. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi, the Democrat from California, said in a written statement, no one can be allowed to stand in the way of the truth, particularly not the previous president who instigated and encouraged the insurrection, end quote from Nancy Pelosi. Now, the panel has issued subpoenas to at least 20 top Trump aides, including former Trump Chief of Staff Mark Meadows and advisor Steve K. Bannon. The House last month voted to hold Bannon in criminal contempt for failing to cooperate, referring his case to the Justice Department for potential prosecution on Friday. Former Justice Department official Jeffrey Clark also refused to answer questions about whether Trump attempted to use his apartment to overturn the election during a closed-door interview with the panel. So six others issued subpoenas last Thursday were legal scholar John Eastman, a former New York police commissioner, Bernard Kirk, who were active in the Willard Hotel Command Center, where Trump's loyal backers oversaw efforts in January to overturn the 2020 election. The rest included a re-election campaign manager Bill Stepien, senior advisor Jason Miller, national executive assistant Angela McCullen, and former Trump National Security Advisor Michael Flynn. On Tuesday, the panel issued subpoenas to 10 other Trump administration officials, including John McNetty, the former White House personal director, Ben Williamson, a former deputy assistant to the president, Nicholas Luma, the former president's personal assistant, and Molly Michael, the Oval Office operations coordinator to President Trump as well. Stay in Trump land for this next story as well.
Teen senior members of former President Donald Trump's administration illegally campaigned for Trump's 2020 re-election bid while still government officials, a federal agency said Tuesday. Included in those 13, former Trump advisors Jared Kushner, also Trump's son-in-law, and Kellyanne Conway. The two were among those cited in a report by the Office of Special Counsel, an independent federal watchdog within the U.S. government that investigates violations of the Hatch Act, a law limiting the political participation and speech of federal employees. The report was the culmination of an investigation that began while Trump was in office, following his decision to hold the 2020 Republican National Convention at the White House, which, along with other violations, amounted to what the OSC called a, quote, taxpayer-funded campaign apparatus within the upper echelons of the executive branch.
Because President Trump has put his America First vision into action,
the report also found that former Secretary of State Mike Pompeo and former Department of Homeland Security Secretary Chad Wolf violated the Hatch Act by taking part in the convention, while Kushner and Conway, as well as former White House Chief of Staff Mark Meadows, also ran afoul of the law when they criticized now President Joe Biden's campaign during media appearances. Representatives for Trump and other officials cited in the report did not immediately respond to requests for comment. Despite the infractions, the Office of Special Counsel said discipline was no longer possible because the Trump administration officials have left office, but said it was issuing the report to highlight enforcement challenges and to deter future violations.
Stay with us. We'll be right back.
It goes without saying that this show does not happen without listener support. Support the Darrell McClain Show by going to www.patreon.com and getting a membership for $3, or you can go to buzzsprouts.com/the Darrell McClain Show and hit the subscribe button and join there. Many ways to donate to the show. Independent media that won't reinforce tribalism. We have one planet. Nobody is leaving, so let us reason together. www.patreon.com/the Darrell McClain Show, or go to Buzzsprouts and to the Darrell McClain Show and subscribe. So that is going to be our last Trumpland story. Now, there is a full detailed story in the Washington Post that I'm going to link to in the show notes. It's about 5 pages of a read. If you want to get a more detailed look at what they are alleging these officials have done, the 13 Trump officials who they are saying illegally campaign while in office, so you can read the details of that federal investigation there. I kind of, even though I still believe that Donald Trump is very important, I think that the media's obsession with Donald Trump has kind of is wore me out of even being able to talk about certain things when it comes to the president, because I'm somewhat tired of the fascination around the former president. I think I've said before that it is because the media has buyer's remorse, because Donald Trump was a media-built entity. From his show on the Celebrity Apprentice, to him being on, the WWE several times, for him being on Comedy Central's roast, to him ascending to the White House and getting 50 billion dollars of free ad time because he was always on all the networks, when other candidates who may have had at the time been more substantive and had more coveted experience could not crack 5% of the polls because nobody knew they were running. So I think that now, when Trump got elected, the media has done everything they can to do a overcorrection and tear down everything that is Trump. The Empire Strikes Back, as to say. So I got an opinion piece here that I'm going to read in its entirety. Why on earth are Republicans still blocking these voting rights bills? Now, this is from the editorial board of the Washington Post. Republican senators last week blocked another big voting rights bill, the John Lewis Voting Rights Advancement Act. This one should have been even less controversial than the one before it. The legislation would have fixed the 1965 Voting Rights Act, a law that for decades protected minority communities from discrimination at the ballot box. The Supreme Court in 2013 hobbled the law, declaring that Congress must update the policy for it to once again apply. Congressional Republicans, who overwhelmingly supported the law as recently as 2006, however, refused. Only a single Republican, Senator Lisa Murkowski from Alaska, voted with Senate Democrats seeking to patch it. So this is the third voting bill Republicans have rejected this year. Democrats first tried advancing a sprawling bill containing a wish list of reforms on everything from voting procedures to campaign finance to judicial ethics. That one was a stretch. Was a stretch even for Democrats, such as moderate Senator Joe Manchin of West Virginia. I already said before, I want to stop calling senators moderates. I want to start calling them corporatists. But anyway, that crosses party lines. But next was a drastically scaled back bill that Manchin drafted with Senator Amy Klobuchar, the Democrat from Minnesota. It would have required states to meet some minimum standards in federal elections, such as providing a certain amount of early voting and permitting universal access to absentee ballots. It also would have restricted gerrymandering of legislative districts maps, just as the nation is witnessing both parties conduct a new round of aggressive partisan map manipulation from Ohio to North Carolina to New York to Illinois. There was no good reason to oppose such modest steps, but Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell, the Republican from Kentucky, actually accused Democrats of trying to start tearing up the ground rules of our democracy and writing new ones, of course, only a purely partisan basis. This, of course, is precisely what Republicans have been doing in state after state following the 2020 election and former President Donald Trump unending accusations of fraud. So finally, last week's Democrats brought up the John Lewis bill. Mr. McConnell railed that seeking to restore a decades-old voting protection, Democrats sought a federal takeover of elections and to overturn the courts, even though the Supreme Court said explicitly that Congress was free to update and reimpose the 1965 Voting Rights Act rules. Senate Republicans' real object seems to be enabling state-level Republicans to continue making it harder to vote in an effort to tilt the playing field their way. Now, the irony is that their latest blockade came a day after Republicans swept to victory in Virginia, a state in which Democrats had lifted many unnecessary barriers to voting. Republicans won not because they successfully discouraged voting, but because they maximized turnout. Republicans do not need to curb Americans' ability to vote in order to win. They simply need to advance more appealing candidates running on a more popular party platforms. Every American, Democrat or Republican, should favor reforms to promote voter participation and honest competition between the parties. Senate Republicans have proved time and time again that it is not what they want, even as voting rights come under attack in many states. At this point, Democrats must consider reforming the filibuster to allow the Senate to debate and vote on the measures to protect the franchise. So that was from the members of the editorial board and the areas of focus. And that was an opinion piece that I thought was fairly decent from the Washington Post. I have always said that I pay very close attention to somebody who is trying to curtail or make it more difficult for me to do something. It normally means that I'm going to go out of my way to do it. I'm not one of those people who thinks that that if you tell somebody they need an ID to vote, that that is some way disenfranchising them. I've never taken that argument very seriously, one. And two, if that was something that was a impediment or to people voting, if it, then I think that the Democratic Party, because they're the ones that say that, that's why I'm singling them out, if they have enough rich people in their party that if their constituents cannot get an ID, that there can be several programs made to make that happen. There are college IDs that are accepted in a lot of states. You don't have to have a driver's license. A lot of states, in lieu of a driver's license, have state IDs. There are states that have state-issued department badges, like me, for example, when I do private security. I have a badge issued by the state with my driver's license picture on it. That is called the Department of Criminal Justice security license. My state also allowed a previous one, the one I was born in, allowed us to vote with our concealed weapons permits, not because our concealed weapons permit came with a photo ID on them, and along with your voting registration. I have voted in every election since I was 18 years old. I have voted lots of times using absentee ballots because I was in the United States military, so I was able to vote absentee by mail. I think that it's perfectly fine that if they can come up with a system to allow military members to vote on the computer through their CAT cards. I think there are several ways to fix this voting problem. I think that the cat is out of the bag when it comes to the government's ability to print money out of thin air and give it to people, whether they deserve it or not. I think the stimulus payments, round one, round two, round three, ripped that Band-Aid right off. So I think the way to fix this is to just have an election 2 weeks. And the government has 2 weeks for you to vote for who you want to be president of these here United States, as long with congressmen and senators. And I think the one, you still get 1 day off to vote, with a 1 day in case the polls close before you got there. And the government will pay your salary for those 2 days, giving that money, subsidizing that to your employer and giving it to them that way. And that is a way that everybody can have access to the ballots. If there are any rule changes like a voter ID or something like that, I postulate that you fix that by saying no rule changes can happen within 6 months of an election. That gives 6 months is a long time for people to get whatever paperwork is needed to go vote, to get their addresses changed, to get an appointment at the DMV, to get an ID or a driver's license, to get some form of accepted photo ID as required to vote. So I think that would be an appropriate amount of time, and I mean this statewide, federally. When it comes to the filibuster, I think it's common sense. I've never really liked the legal maneuver where the people, the American people, can go and pick their leaders and say, this is what we would like to happen. And even if I'm out of power, I've always been very uncomfortable with the minority party or the party who lost being able to procedurally stop the party who won from getting the agenda or getting what they want done. But I guess I'm a bit radical when it comes to that. I am somebody who for the longest time and still my position is unchanged. I don't even believe in presidential term limits. I think we have term limits and they're called elections. The president that said this when I was on the show with one of these professors wrote a really good book. His name escapes me. But anyway, I said the presidential, the executive branch was supposed to be co-equals with the legislative branch and the judicial branch. If the judicial branch does not have term limits and the Congress and the Senate does not have term limits, you cannot seriously call the president a co-equal if you give him a term limit. The term limits should be equal across the board for all of the three branches of government, the executive, judicial, and the legislative. And I really think that only changed because FDR got four terms, and once, you know, he passed away, the Senate did and the Congress did a changing in the laws that I think really shouldn't have happened. But that's just my opinion on that particular matter. So the QAnon shaman, the guy that is seen with the Viking helmet on and the American face paint, that is the picture that was shared most, January 6th insurrection or whatever, was sentenced to 41 months in prison for his role on Capitol Hill. So Jacob Chasley, who is a brightly painted face, tattooed torso, and horned cape, became a visual icon of the January 6th attack on the U.S. Capitol. And he was sentenced Wednesday to 41 months in prison by a federal judge in Washington. His lawyer had asked the judge to impose a sentence of time already served, basically the entire 10 months since the insurrection, during which Chasley attracted more attention for demanding an organic diet while in jail, and had given an interview to 60 Minutes. Now, the sentence of roughly 3.5 years is equal to the longest yet handed down to any Capitol rioter of roughly 130 people who have pled guilty so far. Only 16 have admitted to felonies, and Chansley is the fourth felon to be sentenced. The other three received terms of 8 months, 14 months, and last week 41 months to a man who punched a Capitol police officer. Chansley, 34, who was photographed parading shirtless through the halls of the Capitol with a 6-foot spear howling through a bullhorn and then sitting in the vice president's chair in the Senate. He became known as the QAnon shaman because of his appearance at gatherings of QAnon conspiracy theorists and his shamanistic religious beliefs. Now, prosecutors quoted Chansley offering prayer while sitting on the Senate dais, thanking God for filling this chamber with patriots that love you. Thank you for allowing us to get rid of the communists and the globalists and the traitors within our government. Chansley, now famous criminal acts made him the public face of the Capitol riot. Prosecutors wrote in a sentencing memo which suggested sentencing range between 41 to 51 months. The government asked for the maximum of 51 months. Chansley's lawyer, Albert S. Watkins, argued that the client has been sufficiently penalized by his 10 months in jail already. The lawyer went on to say, Mr. Chansley is in dire need of mental health treatments. Watkins wrote in his sentencing memo, he said that the psychological evaluation earlier this year found that Chansley suffered from schizotypal personality disorder, anxiety, and depression. Now, Watkins asked U.S. District Judge Royce Lampert to go below the sentencing guidelines range and release his client due to part of Chainley's mental health infirmities of significance. Chainley spoke to the judge for about 30 minutes, repeatedly invoking his spiritual guides of Jesus Christ and Gandhi. Gandhi would allow his loyalty to God, to truth, to guide him to accept responsibility. Chansley said, I was wrong for entering the Capitol. I have no excuse whatsoever. My behavior was indefensible. Chainley's lengthy comments in which he praised Lombard's military service as a lawyer and judge advocate. General Corp seemed to convince the judge that he had made significant changes. I think your remarks are the most remarkable that I've heard in 34 years as a judge, Lambert said. I think you're genuine in your remorse. Parts of those remarks are akin to the kinds of things that Martin Luther King would have said. Yeah, but anyway, but Lambert said he could not reduce Changeley's sentence below that recommended guidelines. What you did was horrific, the judge said, as you now concede, and obstructing the government as you did is this type of conduct is so serious that I cannot justify a downward departure. I do think the minimum end of guidelines is what you have earned because you've done everything right from time that you started. And you've and certainly done everything good today. Convince the court that you are a new person. Changeley, who lives in Phoenix, had grown a following on various social media platforms in the months before January 6th and posted messages such as, "We shall have no real hope to survive the enemy's raid against us until we hang the traitors lurking among us," a prosecutor said. Assistant U.S. Attorney Kimberly L. Pascoe noted that Changeley and Watkins have frequently claimed that his protesters were peaceful. Reading from his social media post, Pascoe said, "This is not peaceful. It's a call to battle." So Changeley drove from Phoenix to Washington and was the first spotted outside of the Capitol at 1:50 p.m. January 6th, according to court records. There was ample photo and video documentation of Changeley's motivations, movements, wearing a fur vest, carrying an American flag tied to a pole with a spear and a tip, and using a bullhorn. Pascoe played some of a bit of it to Lambert on Wednesday. Prosecutor said Changeley was among the first rioters inside the Capitol. He was also the first one indicted. Changeley used his bullhorn to rile up the crowd and demand the lawmakers be brought out. Prosecutors said at 2:52 p.m. he entered the Senate gallery and began screaming obscenities on one of the videos showed. So this, I guess, there's a saying online, you fucked around and found out. So I guess that's what this goes under. That he didn't kill anyone. He didn't do anything violent. He did storm the Capitol, and it's a felony. Felony is hard for certain people to get over. Certain people, you can have 15 felonies, and you'll still be forgiven and still be hired. And I think that this guy, even when he gets out of jail, is going to be hailed as some type of hero, and he'll probably have a news job on Fox News or one of the conservative networks. So jail is not anything that I advocate for people being in, but I do think this he'll be fine when he gets out. When it comes to conversations about his mental health, etc., I find it a bit cheap, only because I think I've said this before, but this is why. I know a lot of people who have varied degrees of mental health problems. They don't do the type of stuff that this person did, right? They still somehow, with all the mental problems that they have, whether it's PTSD or whether it's schizophrenia, whether it is anxiety, depression, anything they suffer from, alcoholism, and they still somehow allow themselves to be normal, everyday, productive members of society. This person was mentally capable enough to travel from Arizona to Washington, D.C., whether he drove or whether he got on a plane. If he got on a plane, he was mentally capable enough to buy a plane ticket. He was mentally capable enough to show up to the airport on time. He was mentally capable enough to check his bags, paint his body, and storm the Capitol. If he drove, he was mentally capable enough to pack his bags, pack his gear, pack his spear, pack his body paint, and take the undertaking of going all the way from Arizona to Washington, D.C., which is no small undertaking. That is a very long trip. If you could do that, then you are fully, fully capable of getting to the steps of the Capitol and saying, I may be about to make a mistake. I think I need to turn around. I think this may be the wrong thing to do. That is not what he did. This was calculated, it was planned, it was cerebral, and as the older people used to say, you did the crime, and now you must do the time. Again, I take no pleasure in anybody being in jail. I find it rather, it's a whole other conversation about what I think about prisons. But I there's something that always grinds my gears, as Peter Griffin would say, when somebody, a lawyer, tries to say that somebody has done some crime because of a mental disability. You did the crime because you calculated and you planned and you wanted to do the crime. And that's the truth.
We read one day, we hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their creator with certain inalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. But if a man doesn't have a job or an income, he has neither life nor liberty and the possibility for the pursuit of happiness. He merely exists. Estimated that we spend $322,000 for each enemy we kill in Vietnam, while we spend in the so-called war on poverty in America only about $53 for each person classified as poor. The promises of the Great Society have been shot down on the battlefield of Vietnam, making the poor, white and Negro, bear the heaviest burdens both at the front and at home. The other thing I want you to understand is this, that it didn't cost the nation one penny to integrate lunch counters. It didn't cost the nation one penny to guarantee the right to vote. But now we are dealing with issues that cannot be solved without the nation spending billions of dollars and undergoing a radical redistribution of economic power.
Yeah.
All labor has dignity.
Yes.
But you are doing another thing. You are reminding not only Memphis, but you are reminding the nation that it is a crime for people to live in this rich nation and receive starvation wages.
So there we have it, the blast from the intellectual past. That was a voice from the late Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. talking about something that a lot of people probably have not heard him heard when they think about Dr. King, his economic policy. You can get a book written by Dr. King a long time ago, Where Do We Go From Here? Chaos Our Community. Again, that book is called Where Do We Go From Here? Chaos in Our Community. And of course, you can find it on Amazon.com, less than $10 to go read Martin Luther King's views on economics, with a foreshadowing in that book from his late wife, Coretta Scott King. Thank you for tuning in. Of course, if you want to support the show, you can do so by going to Patreon/The Daryl McClain Show. You can also, if you want to have communication, find me on any of the social media networks. I'm normally very present on Instagram. Thank you. See you on the next episode. Thank you for listening to today's episode. Of course, if you want to support the show, you can do so by going to www.patreon.com and getting a membership for as little as $3 a month. Again, that's www.patreon.com/The Daryl McClain Show. The Daroma Clan Show is fully listener-supported, independent media that won't lead you to tribalism. Get a membership and support independent media at www.patreon.com/The Daroma Clan Show.